We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your hosts, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 397. Scott, final episode with you and me of 2019. What's up? You're back from your trek around New Jersey and New York, seeing family?
Yeah. It's usually the holidays are me bouncing around to every single person that's in my family so that they can, especially ones that haven't met met Kemp yet. And there were a handful of them, of extended family. So we were pretty much, probably not stationary for more than 2 hours at a time. And we were bouncing around. But it was fun. Good to see everybody. I'm exaggerating. Got a little bit of R&R time at my sister's place. But yeah, it was fun. It was a good time. It's always fun. Like, I'm a big Christmas family guy. And I actually don't think I've ever not spent Christmas Day with my family. Every single Christmas that I've been alive, it's always been that. Because my wife and I have a deal where Christmas is with my family, usually Thanksgiving is with her family. And so, yeah, yes. I don't think I've ever missed one with my family, which is pretty crazy considering I've been around for a while.
The holiday trades, it gets heated. People start taking offense if you skip a holiday. It's like, just everyone relax, please.
Yeah.
Once you have your own family, let's just call it what it is. I'm going to see you when I see you and just move on, please.
But there are also some things that are, sacred to the way that you do traditions and the way that you approach some holidays. And coming down on Christmas Day for us as kids was always a big deal. And we kind of have now pushed that into our kids. And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun watching the kids run down and see some of the stuff and their expressions and things like that.
You did, obviously, they believe in Santa.
Yes.
So
because Santa is
for any 7-year-olds listening out there,
which there are.
So did you guys wake up in the middle of the night to put the presents out, or
no? Santa did that. Santa came down the chimney and delivered every single present, and he ate the cookies, drank the milk, Rudolph ate the carrot, and then we had a great Christmas.
Nice. Lovely. Did one of you dress up as Santa?
No.
Do you have a fake Santa show up to the party?
No. Santa has his helpers, but not this time. His helpers did not come around. He was the big guy took care of it on his own.
I was going to ask you, at what age did you stop believing in Santa Claus? But it sounds like you still believe.
I do believe because he is very real.
Do you? Well, we all know Brian Cashman is Santa Claus. He dressed up as Santa Claus.
He's definitely one of his helpers. Yes.
To rappel down one of those buildings one year. But he's a Cashman is a Santa helper.
Of course. That's why the whole pun is so great about having the fact that the Cashman has actually put coal in our stocking this year. So it's a bad thing,
isn't it?
Well, that's why it's a pun. It's actually a good thing for this particular one. There's a spelling difference, It's like the Schwartz, There's the good, there's the bad. This is the good spelling of coal.
So we've got a lot of mailbags to go through today. Some of the ones that we didn't get to on the last episode, and also some, not much has happened as far as the Yankees go. And I feel like that's going to be a trend from here on out since they got Gerrit Cole. That was the big fish this offseason. And we kind of discussed, all right, what else is there to do? A couple minor moves we might see, but I don't expect anything major to be happening between now and spring training. Maybe that makes for a boring next 2 months. Or maybe it just made for a really exciting December, which we didn't have the last couple of years.
Yeah, and that's fine. The fireworks have happened. We got what we came for in the off season. I think some of the things that were a little, you and I I don't remember in your plan if you had Betances coming back or if you had Didi coming back, but Nick and I
neither.
Nick and I kind of saw the writing on the wall, and I think you guys did too, in the sense that it's not that we don't want them back. It's not that we don't want them on this team. It's just that it was pretty clear and evident the way that the Yankees have approached things in the past and the way that they've approached, those two situations, obviously with Glaber being there and able to play short and controlled, and then you have a guy with Betances who they've just never really treated well ever. So why would they start now? And that's exactly how it panned out, and he got unfortunately banished to the Mets. But, I think the writing was on the wall, but
seeing now what he signed for, Do you think the Yankees have made a mistake not at least matching the 1 year, $10.5 million guaranteed contract? That's a prove me contract.
Yeah.
So we had sort of discussed, well, if a team is out there willing to give Betances 2 or 3 years, the Yankees are not going to do that because the bullpen is a position of strength and they don't need to do that for Betances, which in reality is a luxury for the Yankees. But seeing as what he got, are you disappointed they would not at least match that?
I mean, disappointed, probably no, because I was expecting it. And, there could also be something like this. You know, the Yankees probably, with what happened in 2019 and the injuries, they're not going to try to walk into the season with a guy after giving them a brand new contract that is still relatively up in the air with what's happening with that Achilles. And he's a big-bodied guy that that has, you know, a violent delivery, or, you know, he's just, there's a lot of moving parts there. And I think when you come in with a partially torn Achilles, there's definitely question there, and there's definitely some cloud and haze around that situation. So I don't think the Yankees wanted to start the season with, you know, that relative uncertainty in the back of the pen. I think they want to probably have something solidified. And if the Mets are going to pay him that much money, that's, and it's not fully guaranteed on how much he's going to play, because there's incentives in that contract for the amount of games, which clearly says, you know,
70 games.
Hopefully you play. If you play a lot of games,
that's not really them. That's $2.5 million of incentives if he reaches that 70 game mark. So
that's $2.5 million.
Mets being the cheap bastards that they are, just holding them back at 69 games. Nice.
But that's you know, 20% of the contract. So that's a significant percentage of his contract. So you have some built-in incentives there. But the reason those incentives are there is because there's an injury uncertainty on the player. So, you know, I think the Yankees didn't want to deal with that. They didn't want to go with that one-year deal on a guy that might be damaged goods. And who knows, maybe their medical staff, which is now very much up in the air, says, you know, we don't think he's going to rehab well from this, and it could be a problem all season. So who knows? I think the Yankees will very much reassess what happens after next year.
So I've seen that narrative that, oh, the Yankees must know something with Betances.
Well, every doctors have different opinions about people, right? And the way that they view injuries and how people are going to rehab from it. So maybe they think differently.
No, I just love the fact that there's people out there that no matter what the Yankees do, it's the right move, because they must know that
those people exist. It's usually on the other side.
There's also the people that think no matter what they do, it's wrong.
Right.
But mostly, if Brian Cashman makes a decision, he knows something. Good or bad, he knows something.
Right. And it's possible, you know, the fact that the Achilles is scary to me.
Brian Cashman, the thing he's best at is building a bullpen.
That's true. I mean, you can't deny the talent. That's the thing, though. You're saying that based on him identifying talent for that bullpen. And that's not the case here. This is a different case.
No, I know. But evaluating, making decisions for the bullpen, I think that is Brian Cashman's biggest strength. That's the area he hits on most.
Sure. I don't know if this is in the same realm of those decisions, though. Because this one,
I think this
is all about
primarily
the
a financial decision.
Well, yes, but it's also the financial decision is directly related to the medicals.
I don't know, because I the $10.5 million would pretty much all but guarantee them going over the top tax threshold. And I still think they're going to end up over it because of they're so close to it right now. Any additions they make in season, unless they subtract salary off, they're going to be over it. But signing Betances to $10.5 million would all but guarantee they're over it.
Yes.
So I think that's the driving factor here.
Sure. But
I don't think they would have re-signed him even if he did not have that Achilles issue at the end of the year.
Well,
if he came back and pitched, rehabbing from the injury he had all season, didn't ever mess up his Achilles, I still don't think he's a Yankee next year.
The reason I'm saying it's attached to the medicals is because I don't think Dellin Betances is signing a one-year deal today without those medicals. So if he were fully healthy,
that's also a good point.
And
if
shown
he didn't have
that,
the Achilles,
yeah, then. And shown that he didn't have that Achilles and pitched well in the playoffs, he's not signing a one-year deal. So that could have changed the situation.
So as we were talking about Betances, my dad walked in the room because I'm recording in his office.
I don't believe that your dad's in the room.
Note. He's not in the room right now. He's in the office next door, but he gave me a post-it. So this is a little mailbag question from my dad. Need a left-handed power underlined bat. Number 44, Reggie, not walking into the locker room. Although Reggie does walk into the locker room quite often.
During the regular season. Takes guys out to get frozen yogurt. Not ice cream, but frozen yogurt.
My dad thinks that they're too right-handed heavy.
Well, then your dad definitely believes in the splits with lefty-righty rather than the actual number splits. Is that also fairly accurate? I'm surprised you haven't like shown him the way with the analytics.
I've tried.
I mean, he's still referring to Reggie as the power bat. So it's good. that's going to be a tough one to overcome. But if you look at what they are visibly with the eye, if you're going by that,
on paper, they're very right-handed heavy. The starting lineup, projected starting lineup for opening day next year is going to have one, maybe two left-handed bats in it.
Who's the second?
Gardner and Tauchman, if Tauchman starts in the outfield.
Gardner and Tauchman, yeah.
Well, Stanton would start at DH, mm-hmm. and then Gardner would be in left, Tauchman in center. But there's going to be plenty of days where it's just Gardner or Tauchman in the lineup, and everyone else is going to be right-handed.
Yeah.
Except maybe Mike Ford, if he's there. Mike Ford might get a day at first base.
This is definitely a real possibility. I mean, the Yankees have been linked to some guys that are left-handed.
That's just a left-handed bat for the sake of a left-handed bat. They're not a good hitter. None of those guys are better hitters than the right-handed hitters they have. So I don't want them batting just because they're left-handed.
Right. Correct. That's the thing. I think when you start looking at the splits and you see how the Yankees can actually handle left-handed pitch or right-handed pitching, and you look at the splits, that it's not as big of a deal as most make it. You know, I think it does become more of an consideration when you're in a playoff scenario when there's more pitchers being used. I think, and there's a lot more changes being used, and then you got head games and there's a lot more things that happen.
Three batter rule next year.
Right. But that doesn't affect when there's two outs or when there's one out.
But so the three batter rule, no, it doesn't. But the three batter rule sort of negates the having to stack lineups, because the idea to stacking a lineup was you don't have all right-handed hitters or all left-handed hitters in a line, because then they could get exposed to a pitcher coming in.
I mean, this is all contingent on them, you know, there being less than two outs for them to have to face three guys. So.
Yes, if it's
the scenarios we've seen this. The scenarios are
the only
very
way they
slim.
Can face less than three batters is if an injury or if there's two outs in the inning and he gets the guy out and then they can go to a new pitcher. They basically want to stop. Do you remember that game the Yankees played against the Padres last year? And
yes.
The manager made, I think, five pitching changes for five straight batters.
Yes.
And he was like, and it was kind of raining too. So we're like, oh, is he just trying to run out the clock here and make sure that the grounds crew has to call the game or something like that?
Yeah.
That's what baseball wants to avoid, where in a five batter span, it takes 35 minutes because the jackass on the other side makes a pitching change every batter.
Right. They're really trying to claw at every small scenario to try to shave off like 3 minutes from a game.
Yeah.
It's pretty dumb.
So baseball's pace of play is a forest fire. And Rob Manfred is like, oh, I'm going to take a leak on it to try and put that forest fire out. Instead of
you would think with all
actually
the analytics
trying to put it out.
And all the nerds now that work for MLB and all of the, you know, the games that have been played in Major League Baseball history, that they could come up with some better ideas to shave significant time off of it. But
they're just gonna do everything circling the problem. They're circling the problem.
They know. Hopefully, they know that
enough things will be fixed that the problem goes away. But we all know that's not gonna happen.
Well, it's also, you know, let's just tell everybody we're trying to do it so that they think we're trying to do it when we really know what the real issue is and how to fix it immediately. Let's just make the ads shorter. Let's just put the ads in play. Let's just do something with that side of it that will actually shave down the middle of the game.
Well, that will.
And they won't.
But the issue as far as the product on the field is that everything is a home run, a strikeout, or a walk. And all of those things take a long time.
That is definitely a bigger problem.
There's a problem in some people's
view.
Well, the as far as an action standpoint, right?
Yeah.
There's fewer balls being put in play, which means there's less of a chance for action. Every out takes longer because there's less movement. There's less balls being put in play. There's less base runners. It's a walk, a strikeout, or a home run. Those all take a long time to move the game forward. Two of those things don't actually get an out, and the other one is the longest way to get an out, is a strikeout. Minimum 3 pitches to get a strikeout. Usually more like 4, 5, or 6 pitches.
Yep. So maybe they should unjuice the balls. Let's make some lead balls with some high seams.
According to baseball, the balls are not juiced. It's just the seam heights vary.
Which is true. They can't fit visibly.
And that they don't see that as a problem. That's just something people are going to have to get used to.
Yeah. See, there's a thing. In my day job, we work on government contract. We deal with some large machinery that cuts metal. Okay, and we sell. It goes a lot to like the arsenals or the Navy yards and things like that, for the government and the military. And we deal with very, very tight accuracies, precisions. Like think of a gun barrel or something. You know, something that has to be very tight. That has to be. There's still a variance even when you're talking about something as specific as that. And when you're talking about these balls being made, the accuracies of the seams on each ball can definitely be getting tighter. There's no doubt. Like they're talking about a variance, but that variance should not be visible to the naked eye. That variance from one ball to another, from ball 1 to ball 10, should not be a visible sign, a visible variance of the height of that seam. There should be much tighter constraints on these. And if that's what they're saying, and they're saying that it's not a big deal, well, I disagree, because I think it is a big deal with the seams, because you can visibly see the difference in these seams. I mean, it's very clear.
Do you remember when David Cohn was in the booth and he picked up the baseball?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
And he was like, oh, yeah, it's easy. I can feel it immediately.
Of course these guys can feel it. They're used to something. You can, I mean, I'm curious to see how many of these guys that get blisters on a normal basis didn't get hurt this year. I bet the numbers were down. I don't know what they are. I'm just talking about this as I'm thinking it, but I bet they were down because what happens
lower,
is
there's less.
Yeah.
So you're saying the lower seams would cause fewer blisters.
Correct. I think a lot of times when these guys are trying to get better grips, they're using the seams to their advantage, and a lot of times that will open up some of these blisters on some of these guys. Like the Rich Hills of the world, like these guys are really getting up. They're using those seams to get as much, downward action and spin as they possibly can. And I think they use them, more than a lot of other guys, but I would be interested to see those numbers.
So the pitcher performance is one aspect of it, but the aspect that causes more home runs is more the fact that the balls travel further. There's less air resistance when the seams are lower. And the ball, even if it travels 6 or 7 feet farther, well, that could be the difference between a warning track out and a home run. That's a big difference.
So it sounds like you're agreeing that it's the seams and it's causing the aerodynamics of the ball to increase and travel further rather than a juiced ball?
No, that's what they mean by juiced ball. It's not actually like a tighter core.
It could be.
Juice ball is sort of like a catch-all term because.
But remember the term in the early 80s or something, the Athletic,
rabbit ball.
Yeah, but didn't the Athletic cut the ball and identify that it was still also a tighter core as well?
I'm forgetting. I'd be talking out of my ass at this point, which I am known to do. But no, yeah. I think the seams is the biggest thing. No one is saying that baseball that the seams don't vary, but the fact of the matter is. The seams are so much different that it caused a 22% increase in home runs last year.
Yeah.
The seams should not vary to cause a 20%+ increase. If you want to say 2 to 3 to 4% year over year, that's sort of in the margin of error. 22% is not a margin of error.
No, that's a drastic difference. Yeah, it's a drastic difference. I mean, you basically eliminated the fastball pitchers that get fly ball outs. J-Hap was eliminated this year.
Yeah. And Justin Verlander was still a great pitcher, but he gave up the most home runs in the American League this year.
Right.
Justin Verlander should not be allowing the most home runs in the American
League. I mean, he gives up a lot of home runs on a given year. He's usually up in the ranks, like top 10, I think. But no, number one, that's definitely not a thing. He should not be that guy.
There was an article written on The Ringer a few weeks ago about this, and there was a quote I found interesting. It was an anonymous GM said, a 2014 style ball would render fly ball pitchers more valuable. A 2019 style ball would reduce the need to chase power in the lineup because even feckless middle infielders can thwack toward 20 dingers.
Feckless and thwack?
Yeah.
That's all I heard.
So basically, if you're constructing a team for 2020, what kind of baseball am I going to get?
Yeah, it's a good question. And that's what I was talking about. Baseball and you know, Rawlings makes the baseball. MLB owns Rawlings. So there's kind of a conflict of interest here, some would say. The thing is that I think the owners and everybody who's playing the game should be aware of what's happening. That should be a transparent process. The fact that these balls, which they use to play the game, same balls, they use, you know, the game of baseball that's actually being played on the field, it's what they use. It's what they grown men throw back and forth to each other. If they don't know what's coming, then they can't then, you know, make the adjustments that potentially need to be made in the offseason. You know, some of these guys really have to change what they do. Jay Happ has to change what he does if the ball is the same. He has to.
Well, what if, do you think the fact that it seemingly was a different baseball in the playoffs last
seemingly,
year?
Seemingly, I see there.
I'm sure there's some people out there in baseball that's saying, well, maybe baseball made the change in October of 2019 and we're going to go back to a less juiced ball next year for 2020.
No, I mean, I don't think they made changes. I still don't think they made changes.
Was there a drastic drop in
home runs? I don't want to go back through this whole thing. I don't think they are meteorologists. And I think that what we were seeing as well was a significant uptick in better pitching, because that's what happens in the playoffs. And two, it's colder. That's it. I'm sorry.
We talked about how they got nerds to account for those things.
Sometimes, I just told you this, I don't think those nerds are good at the weather. I don't think those nerds know how to tell the weather and appropriately put that into consideration and make.
What
that
if they got Al Roker to do it?
Then I'd believe it more. So until Al Roker is actually backing these claims, I got some concerns about what they're doing. Now, I don't know. You know, it's just one of those things. Like, it's very, to me, there is difference. There's a very big difference between playoff baseball and regular season baseball. There just is. There's a difference. And when we're talking about the numbers, if they're down a little bit into the playoffs, okay, I'm like, okay, that makes sense. To me, that makes sense. Just not even looking at anything overall, very broad scope, looking at what the game of baseball, it's different. There's better pitching. Stakes are higher. It's colder. I mean, just those things alone would probably lead me to down the path of, okay, the ball probably wasn't hit as far or as hard as it normally is in the regular season.
But what they did was they looked at trajectory and exit velocity to, you can basically determine the likelihood of a ball traveling out of the ballpark based on data from the entire year. A ball hit at X velocity and at X launch angle is going to travel Y distance. And then it didn't travel Y distance.
But it travels Y
minus 10.
But it travels Y distance in 95 degree heat differently. That Y is different in 95 degree heat than it is in 40 degree.
I would send you the article to read if I thought you'd read it.
I won't read it. You're right.
I know.
I'm pretty sure you've said it to me before, and I've breezed through it, and I didn't see anything that was significant in the sense that these guys are telling me.
Is that another weather pun?
These guys are telling me that it's different, because what you just said was an equation that had no variance. There's a variance.
No, it's also accounted for the weather.
Again, show me that they are accounting for it correctly.
I'm not smart enough to show you that.
Well, then,
but the people who wrote the article are smart enough.
I don't know. I think they're just looking at some nerds and they're agreeing with what the nerds say. I think there's a difference. It's fine. It doesn't really matter. It's done and over with. What I do think that should happen is there should be more transparency in the manufacturing of these balls so that ahead of time, the owners and the players, and for all intents and purposes, the fans, should understand what's happening with the baseballs, especially with the question marks. Because obviously there's question marks. We're talking about it still. There are question marks about the baseball. And if you can't show some transparency and have the integrity to show what that ball is going to look like, you got a bigger problem, I think. And to me, that's a systematic problem, and somebody's not saying something for some reason. What is that reason? Why are we talking about that? And that's a problem, I think, because now it's affecting what these guys do for a living and how they make money and how they, you know, how they perform on the field. And that is a direct relation on what they, how they make their money and how much money they make. So, you know, we're, now we're talking livelihoods here.
100% agree that the biggest issue is the lack of consistency. That should be their number one priority, is make the, make it consistent. And then they can find something, a happy medium between record-setting home runs, no home runs. They can tweak it all they want to get the desired number of home runs, but just make it consistent. I think that's what people are most complaining
about. And you know how you become consistent is if you are, if you're transparent and you're, and you're showing, you know, what's happening, and you're actually giving a bit of a peek behind the curtain on these baseballs. You really have no other choice but to be consistent, because now we have a bunch of eyes on it.
Yeah,
that will call you on that thing, and they don't want to do that because now there's too many. We saw what happened when the Athletic writes an article about trash cans being hit. Every kid in high school who can, you know, look at video and rewind and record was on their ass and was finding
every
single possible thing.
That brings up an interesting question: Should Rawlings not be owned by Major League Baseball? Is that a conflict of interest? Should there be a third party that is tasked with ensuring however the baseballs need to be, and it shouldn't be all within the same umbrella of Major League Baseball?
I think that there can absolutely be some kind of system in place where there's a third party checking the baseballs, you know, and actually looking over and just kind of overseeing that process.
An outside consulting agency to ensure quality and consistency.
Yes, like the Mitchell Report.
Because that went so well.
The problem is that who is that agency, and is there a trust with that whomever is doing
it? Of course, there'd be a problem with that.
There's a big problem.
And then in 10 years, there'd be another article written about how that agency is corrupt and how, yeah, it's just a long line of corrupt.
But I'm surprised they haven't implemented said corrupt agency to at least give us a little bit of a PR hit, you know, a nice little PR. Okay, this is who we have.
So they need someone to blame, right?
Yeah.
So if you hire an outside agency,
yeah,
and then shit hits the fan, well, that guy, that company,
yeah,
blame them.
What are they doing?
I'm paying them millions of dollars to make sure our baseballs are consistent, and they're not.
That's definitely not my cousin's former roommate. definitely not.
Have you guys ever seen an untucked button-down? They look bad. Why? Because they weren't meant to be worn that way. Thankfully, there's Untuck It. The original button-down shirt's actually designed to be worn untucked. No matter your size or shape, Untuck It shirts always fall at the perfect untucked length. With more than 50-plus fit combinations, Untuck It shirts look great on tall, short, slim, and athletic guys of all ages. You can find your favorite Untuck It style online or check it out in any of their 80 brick-and-mortar stores. Choose from styles like wrinkle-free button-downs, super soft flannels, outerwear, and more. If you do not have the wrinkle-free button-downs, I highly recommend those because you can throw them in the wash and not have to worry about ironing them. They look great right out of the dryer, and it's so convenient when you know, you're in an apartment, you don't have room for an ironing board, or you just don't know how to iron things because you burn them. Yeah, I've done that before. With Untuck It, your shirts will never look baggy, bulgy, or too long or too big again. Their website is very easy to use. They even have a whole page devoted to helping you find your fit. So whether you're shopping for the perfect holiday gift or just trying to craft a smart, relaxed style of your own, Untuck It is the way to go. Visit untuckit.com and use code BLUE for 20% off at checkout. That's untuckit.com and enter promo code BLUE, BLUE, for 20% off.
Do you remember when I told you I signed a rally towel for a kid?
Yeah.
That is a kid in my niece's class who listens to this show.
Oh, right. That's right. He's what, 9?
8, 9? All I know.
He believes in Santa Claus.
All I know is that my niece is very much on the fence right now. She doesn't know which way to go. She's got her concerns. And I'm not going to be the one where this kid comes into class.
We didn't say one way or the other if there's a Santa Claus or not.
All right. I'm not going to be that. That one is way too close to home.
Uncle Scott, why did you say there's no Santa Claus? Sucks for you. All right, quickly getting back to Betances and I don't even want to call it a hole because he wasn't in the bullpen last year. But do you think there is a void in the bullpen for the Yankees next year? Or is it going to be the five guys we know, Chapman, Britton, Green, Ottavino, and Canely, and then a sixth guy rotating in and out, whether it's Sessa, whether it's Holder, whether it's Heller, possibly Loaisiga. You good with the bullpen?
Yeah, I think the bullpen's still strong. I mean, we're talking about an embarrassment of riches at this point. Like, the five guys that you named are, you know, borderline elite, if all of them. I mean, Ottavino definitely struggled towards the end of the season, but he definitely also showed that he could be an elite reliever at times. I think, speaking of consistency, that guy just needs to lock it down at the end of the season. But I don't think it's a problem. It seems like every year someone has stepped up in the pen. Like you said, Cashman has a very good way of identifying talent that is able to slot into that pen. They did it with Chad Green. They seemingly did it with Sessa. I mean, Sessa has taken a while to project, and his back was against the wall last year without any options, but he was a good piece. He actually pitched well. He pitched well in the playoffs. He pitched well down the stretch. A lot of people want to dismiss him just because of his name, but in fact, he was actually pitching very well last year, and I do think that he's going to be a piece this year in the pen. I think it's, you know, it's his spot right now. He's earned the spot, I think, going into the season, unless he has a disastrous spring, which even that might still land him as on the, you know, the back end of that bullpen. I don't think it's a concern. No, I mean, there's still these rumors flying about Josh Hader. Like, that's a possibility. It wouldn't surprise me either because of the controllability. They want to have a controlled guys. That's a controlled guy, an elite arm. If they still want to go down that path, even though now they've added Cole and it's changed the dynamics of the pitching staff a little bit. But if they want to solidify that back end, and continue that to solidify that back end, that's a road they could go down, or they could look internally. Who knows? Maybe Davey Garcia ends up being a guy in the pen and not in the rotation, which could be another very dynamic arm out of that pen. So I think there's still a lot of possibilities when talking about, adding more pieces to that pen. And you mentioned Ben Heller coming off of a surgery last year, looked really good. I was surprised that he didn't get more play down the stretch, but that's another big arm guy that could come in and pitch and be an effective reliever.
It's interesting when you think about it. So 2017, Tommy Canley was so effective and they got him in that trade and everyone was like, well, yeah, we got Robertson and Todd Frazier, but Tommy Canley's locked up for a few years.
He was the big piece.
An elite reliever. And then he had a lost 2018. But Jonathan Holder stepped up in 2018 and performed better than anyone thought. And then look what happened to those two guys in 2019. Canley was back, and Holder couldn't pitch.
Right.
So there's still some inconsistencies in the back end. I think it wouldn't surprise me if one of those guys we just mentioned, one of those five guys, struggles next year, and they got to have someone else step up. Because that's sort of the nature of relievers year to year.
Yeah, but the guys that you mentioned, those five guys, to me have a track record of succeeding. And I think now we've seen Chad Green enough where we can say and
he got over the hump last year. Couldn't have been worse in April.
Yeah, so you know, if you want to talk about a guy that fell off the rails as well, I mean, you can add Chad Green to that last year. But he corrected himself inside the year, which to me is very impressive. And the fact that he came back and was I know he gave up a big home run. In the playoffs, but I think we agree on this. And a lot of people who watched this all year long and saw the pitch and now know what we know, that was a good pitch that unfortunately the barrel just hit. But I don't see the big drop off from any one of those guys. And I think even when we're looking at 2018, you can identify that as an outlier for Canley.
And Milan on the website a couple days ago wrote about Loaisiga and how he actually could project to be a really effective reliever because he does have four pitches, but he's got two plus pitches. His curveball and his sinker are both far above, especially his curveball, above league average. And then his changeup and four-seam fastball are not great. They're below league average as far as pitch values. So, yes, he could project to be a starter if he could make all four of those pitches work. But a two-pitch pitcher, sinker, curveball, that can play for one or two innings in the bullpen.
No, absolutely. And I think you've seen a lot of, I mean, Chad Green was a similar guy. That's we know a guy named Mariano Rivera who also couldn't, you know, fully master a full arsenal to be an effective starting pitcher. So what he did is just made the two pitches that he can do or one pitch very good.
You can't compare anyone to Mariano.
I'm not saying the production.
Uncomparable.
I'm not saying the production. I'm saying the process of how he got to the bullpen.
Like how he got there. Yeah.
These guys are all guys that couldn't master a full four pitch, five pitch repertoire to be an effective starting pitcher that can go deeper into, the lineup three, four times. These guys are mastering their tool. And we're seeing so many people specializing now with what they can do well, that, you know, and who knows? I really do hope that we see some more longevity from the starting pitching. But these are definitely trends that, with the Yankees especially, they're turning these guys who they think are borderline starters into relievers. Betances was another one. He was part of the Killer Bees. He was a starting pitcher coming up.
Brackman, Betances, and Benuelos. Yeah. Hey, one out of three. That's pretty much the going prospect rate. If you hit on 33% of your prospects.
Benuelos really got just, unfortunately, just ravaged by injury. And to his credit, man, he was back up last year. I mean, this guy keeps fighting back and trying to get back into the big league. So I give him credit for still just, you know, tirelessly fighting up. He's just got bad. I don't know. I don't remember if it was a shoulder or an elbow. I think it was a shoulder, but.
He went to Atlanta, right? Didn't they get in that Chase and Shreve trade?
It was, but it wasn't a Chase and Shreve trade. It was for.
It wasn't?
I mean, Shreve was in the deal, but it wasn't for him. That was not the guy. It was, what's his face?
My arch nemesis?
He was horrible for. He was good for the Braves.
Was it Carpenter?
Yes, David Carpenter.
Yep. I hated David Carpenter.
That was the deal. I think it was David Carpenter and Chase and Shreve for Benuelos and somebody else. And it turned out that the two side pieces were the ones that actually. Were the, you know, became the real.
All right, let's talk about, so we haven't really mentioned much going on with some of these other pitchers that signed in the outlook in the American League, and there's been some major changes with teams. So Bumgarner ended up signing in the National League with Arizona, 5 years, $85 million, with $15 million deferred. That's a little bit less than I think people were projecting he was going to get after they saw the Wheeler contract. But then Ryu signed in Toronto. That directly affects the Yankees. 5 years, $80 million. Keuchel signs with the White Sox. 3 years, $55.5 million. And Kluber's traded to Texas, to the Rangers, from Cleveland. So Cleveland is kind of like a... I can't figure them out.
Yeah, they're an anomaly. It's weird because this is a situation also I think that is similar to the way that the Yankees feel about Betances. You know, maybe... They're just, at this point, the risk is not worth the reward of trying to, you know, banking on a guy that could potentially be hurt. Whereas Kluber, he had a broken forearm and then he had an oblique strain. And, you know, who knows if those are related, probably, in the sense that, like, he was coming back and just wasn't fully
ready.
When
he came back last year, there was a dip in velocity, and I think that's probably concerning. The thing that was most concerning to the Indians. But what the Rangers are banking on is they're taking a risk. They're taking an $18.5 million risk. But if Corey Kluber doesn't turn back into Cy Young Corey Kluber, but turns into a quality number two pitcher, that's a really – they gave up nothing.
You could be a number two, three even and be okay with what they have – with Minor and Lance Lynn, who became Nolan Ryan last year.
How are we talking about Lance Lynn and Mike Minor like as a respectable 1-2 in a rotation?
I don't know, but apparently we need to ask Larry Rothschild that, because we had Lance Lynn ready to go.
Meet Lynn.
It's terrible. But I liked him too. I wanted him to succeed just because I liked
him. Yeah, he was beefy.
I liked the look of it.
Thick.
Yeah. He's the guy I want out there with that ball. But... No, I mean, you look at that, he doesn't need to be a number one like you were talking about.
If he turns back into it.
Yeah, nor am I saying that Minor or Lynn are number ones, because they're not. Lynn pitched like one, but who knows what that really is. If he can come back and do something similar to that, then, you know, that could be a tough three. But there's a lot of question marks around that. But yeah, it was a gamble that they took, and obviously not one that the Indians are wanting to take it. And when you saw the trades that they've made recently and all the rumors about Lindor, yes, Lindor, it makes sense for them to deal because of the control. Like, this is the year to get stuff, to get back.
You can rebuild your farm system. Even needs to be rebuilt, though, because they still have pitching coming up through that system.
They're an interesting case because if they traded Lindor right now, and, you know, a lot of talk with them and the Dodgers with the fit, they are still going to get back major league ready pieces. And now you trade Lindor and you still have a very young, very talented Cleveland Indians team that can still compete in a division that to me is still up for the taking.
Right. Are the Twins going to win 100 games next year?
No, because I think the White Sox are definitely significantly better now. The Indians obviously are what they are. The Tigers are going to suck. Royals probably going to suck. So you have two teams to beat up on. But I think the White Sox are going to be significantly better this year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, there's there's some interesting movement in the American League, and the Red Sox are talking about trading Mookie Betts and trying to offload David Price. So if they do that, can Toronto compete next year?
I mean, they're not far off. If they,
we saw them have all that young talent sort of start to like gel in the second half of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it would not shock me if they take a step forward next year and
I think they win
and win. They could win 87 games next year, right?
Yeah.
Like it's not, it's, and so that become, that makes the division a lot tougher if you have basically four teams and then the Orioles sucking.
No, absolutely. And if you have, you know, effectively that lineup, the offense is where a lot of that young talent is for the Blue Jays. So by adding a guy like, you know, Ryu, it's just kind of, they're trying to solidify that staff because that's the clear weakness, on, you know, on what they're looking at as far as their roster. But yeah, no, it would not surprise me. I mean, I think that we've all identified that Toronto lineup is going to be a pain in the ass for a long time, with the young talent they have up there. It's going to be a pain in the ass. So if they can get some pitching in there, yeah, they could be a thorn for sure.
Are you looking at any of these contracts that these pitchers got? Is that making you question anything?
I mean, it's just it's a year after Hap. And when you see that these contracts, they're all very similar to the Hap deal. The Keuchel deal is almost, it's less, but it's very similar. And you know, he's younger, but is Dallas Keuchel and Jay Hap, are they comparable pitchers at this point in their career? You know, if you want to say, if you look at what Hap did in the second half and made adjustments, because he was a much better pitcher in the second half, you know, that argument could definitely be made because Keuchel was not very good when he went to the Braves either. So, yeah, if you're looking in a range, they're probably all in that similar range. I think Ryu by far is the best pitcher currently right now. And who knows what Bumgarner is on the Arizona Cardinals, on the Arizona Diamondbacks. He could have a resurgence. Again, he's not an old guy. He's
I don't understand. What are the Diamondbacks doing, though?
I have no idea.
Like, well, so they trade Greinke away. He had a massive contract, so I kind of get that. But then you sign an aging Bumgarner?
I mean, the contract is significantly less.
I know it's significantly less, but if you're going to...
Are
you trying to compete or not? That's the thing. I don't understand these teams that are like, we're going to just try and be okay.
Yeah, but at the same time, like if you capture Bumgarner and he's, you know, maybe not the full Madison Bumgarner, but he's a very effective pitcher and he's like a two or a three, which is certainly very possible. We could see this guy come out.
Well, that's what he was last year.
Yeah,
well, he wasn't bad last year. No one's saying Bumgarner sucks anymore.
But the difference in contract.
People still look at Madison Bumgarner and think 2014 World Series MVP. That's what they think when they hear the name.
Fine,
and that's just not the fact.
But he's being paid less AAV than a guy like Jay Happ. So you're still going out there with an effective pitcher and significantly less dollars than Greinke. So I still think that this was them competing while shaving contracts. It's probably a good move for them, honestly. Because if you're looking at a team that maybe can compete and is a fringe competition team, you want to shed that huge contract and replace it with a guy that can still potentially match, you know, a similar production. Because I think that's, it's possible. You could see similar production.
Well, from a financial standpoint of the team, it probably does make sense because if they are competing for a wild card spot next year, that's revenue gained.
Well, and also it gives them the ability to be flexible at a point where they can see more on what their team is at that point.
Yeah.
They have financial flexibility to, you know, to make an adjustment. If Bumgarner is actually pitching, you know, to his capabilities, and he's a clear number one guy, hell of a deal.
It's December 29th, and all of the best free agents are now signed on teams.
As this should be.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Yep.
Like Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association is looking at free agency and saying, okay, this is what we're talking about. This is working right now.
Because now what's going to happen is that now that the free agents are already signed, teams know where they stand. And there, we could still, and I'm sure we will, we are going to see some more trades. So now we're filling up January and a little bit of February because we get pitchers and catchers in February. So that's the taste that we get. But we're going to see January probably dominated by, one, speculation on what teams could be because we kind of know what they look like. And then we'll see some trades. And I think that's exactly how it should be. Now everybody has an idea of where they are, what they've signed, who they are, what they look like, and what they're going to look like in 2020. And now they can make some trades around that. And I think that's good for baseball.
Do you think Keuchel made the right choice holding out, signing for the second half of last year, getting whatever it was, you know, the $18 million prorated money, and then now signing a $55 million contract? Did he make the right choice?
I don't think he made too much less, because he's if you look at the Jay Happ contract, that's probably what he was looking at. You know, if you were to sign at the beginning of last year, something similar to that, and he's signed that. So I don't think it's made much of a difference, honestly.
Yeah,
maybe it got him this 3 years, with a different team.
Maybe it got him a third year guaranteed.
It's, you know, I think the. It certainly opened up a possibility for the White Sox to sign him, because I don't know if the White Sox would have signed him to that contract last year, but I think the White Sox now have made some adjustments and made some good signings and some bats. Encarnacion just signed with them as well. So they think that if they can, you know, add a piece here and there, that they can be competitive. So I think that opportunity opened up for him, where I don't think that opportunity was there last year. And who knows what the other ones were. So, it, you know, he just got 3 years of $55 million. So I don't think he's too upset about it.
All right, let's get to mailbag questions. If you guys want to submit questions, go to bronxpinstripes.com/podcast or hit us up on any of the social channels at Bronx Pinstripes, at Yankees Podcast on Twitter, and Instagram is just at Bronx Pinstripes. You guys know what to do. First one up is from Tim. If Gerrit Cole has a rough first few starts, who do Yankees fans turn on first, Gerrit Cole or Matt Blake for ruining Gerrit Cole? So I remembered Sabathia struggling in the first part of 2009. And I went back and looked it up. His first start of 2009 was in Baltimore. He gave up 8 hits and 6 runs in 4 1/3 innings pitched. The Yankees lost 10-5. And through his first 6 starts, Sabathia's ERA was 4.85 of that year. And then obviously he went on a great run, won 20 games that season and got his ERA into the low 3s. So he was dominant.
His arm was probably still tired.
He was dominant from there on out. But, like, we've seen guys come to New York and take a few games, a few starts, a month or 2 months to just, like, get their bearings. Like, Mark Teixeira sucked in the first part of that season, too. And he was another big money player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, so the question is, who do we turn on first? I think everybody will turn on everybody but Cole at first. They'll give him the benefit of the doubt because everybody wants him to be good, right? So mm-hmm. I think expectations and the fact that you have these visions of who he can be and who he should be, I think will take over and they'll blame somebody else. So
you
I
know
think
what they're gonna blame?
They're gonna blame the Houston Astros and the cheating.
Yes, 100%. They're gonna say, well, why did Gerrit Cole's spin rate improve when he went to Houston? Like, we know they were cheating offensively, but what were they doing on the pitching side? Like, could Gerrit Cole, they'll be saying, could Gerrit Cole have been doing something to get an increased spin rate? What were they doing from a pitching side? We know they were cheating offensively, but what were they doing on the pitching side? That's going to be a topic if Gerrit Cole struggles. So just brace yourself.
I mean, look, I tweeted that I was being a little tongue-in-cheek, but at the same time, it does open up questions. I still think it's a very appropriate question. You can absolutely question that, because if you have an organization that's cheating in the way that they were, that was so premeditated and calculated, maybe they are doing something different, because obviously it's not going to stop them. Like, there's no, once you go over that line, then who the hell cares? You might as well dive in. And there were a couple guys that came of three guys at least that went over there and had significant improvements on their spin rate and resurrected their careers. So,
well,
who knows?
What the Astros did to, quote, fix Gerrit Cole was make him stop throwing sinkers and focus on his four-seam fastball and his curveball, mm-hmm. which he was always had, but just wasn't utilizing in Pittsburgh.
So he's controlling the strike zone. Aaron Boone's going to like that.
But, yeah, just my takeaway or feeling from this is, if Gerrit Cole struggles in his first few starts, just chill out, because we've got 9 years of it.
But Matt Blake will take the brunt, especially because he's on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
And young and has never pitched anything, and people will be all over his ass. But at the same time, they'll also be all over Cashman's ass for bringing a guy in that has no idea what he's doing. That's what the narrative will be.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about Brian Cashman not being able to obtain starting pitching. There's your narrative.
Garrett Cole will be the last one to get blamed.
Yes.
Like, if Garrett Cole sucks all year, then he'll get blamed.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we need some time. We need some longer suckage.
So, God. Mark wants to talk about clutch. I was listening to your talk about clutch. If you're looking for someone who performed way above normal in playoff situations, look at Billy Martin's stats. Career batting average of .257, but .333 in World Series. The other stats are equally as impressive. So I looked this up. Billy Martin was a career .333, .371, .566 hitter in 105 plate appearances in World Series games. Obviously, there's no other playoffs back then. But in the regular season, he was a .258, .300, .373 hitter. So was Billy Martin clutch?
Goddamn right he was.
Even though it's only 105 plate appearances, that's not a very big sample size.
Again, this is where you go. This is where you go rogue from everybody else in the world, and you think that we're saying the same thing, which we're not. We very clearly are not saying the same thing.
Okay,
you're looking at longer stretches. I'm looking at big moments, and I'm not as much considering the longevity and the numbers based on a longer period of time as much.
So
I just know. Who's clutch and who's not? That's it.
So Billy Martin, if you look at it, I was looking at his Baseball Reference playoff, and in one of the World Series, he hit 500. He was, I think, 12 for 24. And then the other ones are more not as great. So that could have been a statistical outlier, which in 105 plate appearances, which isn't a huge sample, makes him have a .333 batting average. But in reality, he's not a .333 hitter.
I didn't watch Billy Martin play. I have no.
Well, you weren't alive.
I have no eyes on this. I don't know what he did in the big moments pertaining to each individual game. I could look it up. I could watch and I could read about it and all these things, but it won't tell me what I need to know. What I could tell you is that some people think the people that were alive back that were alive and watching him play at his peak said he's clutch. I believe them. I looked at the numbers. Okay, feels like clutch. That's all I know. Jeter, yes, he was good in the regular season. Yes, he was good in the postseason. But in the big moments, he was clutch. Bottom line, I don't care what he did in the regular season. Could have been dog shit. He wasn't. Could have been. Didn't matter. All I know is that big moments, I trust Jeter. I want him at the bat. I trust what he's going to do. I think he's going to have a positive impact on the game.
So he's, I mean, almost identical stat lines, regular season versus postseason for Jeter.
Yeah.
Which I think speaks to the consistency, which is what you and I were saying.
No.
We were just saying it in different ways.
No, exactly. You're wrong again. I'm not talking about consistency. That's the thing. I don't care what they do in the regular season. That's my point. You do.
We were talking about consistency in big moments.
Again, this makes no sense. What you're saying, you're talking about a regular season and what they're doing in every moment and what they do on a regular basis when there's zero stress there. I'm only talking about big moments. And I'm not only talking about when I say a guy is clutch. It may just be moving a guy over. It may just be laying a bunt down.
Yeah.
It may just
be. No, I agree with that.
It may just be working
doing something positive.
It may
to
be
help
working
the
count
moment.
In an effective way, but still having an out. It doesn't necessarily have to be the big home run. It doesn't necessarily have to be that big hit. Do I trust them and think that they're going to be in a position to do that? Yes. And that to me is a guy that I feel clutch. I feel like that guy in a bigger moment might change his approach. I think Brett Gardner is that way too. I think Brett Gardner is a guy that lives for big moments. He likes the big moments. You even see him choke it up on the bat a little bit. You see him doing different things to effectively, adjust for that scenario. I like that. I trust Brett Gardner in situations like that. DD was a similar way. I trusted him in some of the big moments. Did it happen every time? No. But in my heart, in my mind, in my eyes, I felt that guy has had more big hits than not clutch.
Well, I like that you brought up it doesn't have to be a hit or a home run to be considered clutch, because I think being a clutch player is positively impacting the game when your team needs it the most. And it can be a 9-pitch at bat that might not end in a home run, but might end in a strikeout. But if you tired out that pitcher and then the next guy's able to get a hit, like you can with your eyes say, okay, even though he struck out, that positively impacted the game versus a player going up there in a key situation and striking out or popping up on one pitch. That is, I think that's important, that will not show up in stats, and that maybe stat nerds will say, well, that's ridiculous. How can you say he's
different.
Clutch if he didn't get a hit?
It's just all
but,
different.
Yeah, you do have to watch the games and all the at-bats.
It's very different because depending on who the player is and what their approach is normally. I mean, we saw Didi last year walk up to the plate in big situations, swing at the first pitch and have really shitty results. We saw that. But we also saw him step up to the plate in big moments and hit the ball out. My thing is for clutch is for me personally, I believe in that guy more than I believe in other guys. Does it happen every time? No. Does Didi attack early in the count? Yes, that's more his approach. So sometimes it'll work, sometimes it won't. But I feel good with him up at the plate. That's really like at the end of the day, do I feel good about this at bat before it happens? And that to me is, you know, what speaks to who's clutch and who's not. It's what I've seen with them, what they've done in the past in big moments. Have they come through? And do I feel confident in them stepping up to the plate in that moment? And it could go for pitchers too.
Derek Jeter had 734 postseason plate appearances.
It's crazy.
And he was essentially the same hitter. So I think when you do...
The problem with what your logic is, though...
There's certain moments that you obviously look at and you think about for Jeter when he had the Mr. November home run and like these big moments that you can point to. But then it is backed up with stats because 734 plate appearances is a large sample.
But here's the thing.
That if he was not, quote, clutch... He would not be the 308, 374, 465 hitter that he is in the playoffs.
Well, I mean, that could also not be true because you could see that in those particular outs within those 734 plate appearances, maybe all the outs are in big moments. So your logic doesn't make any sense.
Not likely.
But it doesn't make any sense. It's not backed up with statistics, actually. And what you're saying here...
Postseason is... It doesn't. There's more opportunity for clutch moments.
Yes, but again, you're not identifying that actual moment. That actual moment matters. And let me tell you something else. You're trying to base something on a regular season and the number of plate appearances. There are not very many guys that have 734 plate appearances in the postseason. That is a very big outlier.
Yeah, definitely. Only basically guys who have basically just the 90s Yankees. Guys who played in the wild card era, so there were three rounds of playoffs and were in the playoffs every year.
Your approach to this is applicable to the 90s Yankees offensive players that were there the entire time and Murderer's Row. And
that's when I go to the statistical leverage index.
Okay.
And then they take out those moments. They isolate those moments that we just talked about.
All right. Okay. Let's move forward, nerd.
Drew, if it was your call, when would you extend DJ LeMahieu and what would the contract look like? LeMahieu's going to be 32. This was in your offseason plan.
Yeah.
But 32 years old this coming July. He had the best season of his career in 2019, where he had 5.4 WAR and a 5.18 slugging percentage. That was also career high. Based on 2020 WAR projections, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
He is worth $22 to $25 million AAV.
Yeah, good for him. Worth every penny.
You would pay him $22 million a year?
No, I'm looking up what I did pay him in the postseason in the deal here.
And just so that is based off of what the going rate for what one WAR is worth, which is between $7 and $8 million, depending on what you know.
But how accurate are any of these projections as far as like what people are actually paid? They're not, right?
No, it's not a projection of what they're paid. It's what is projected for one WAR.
It's just worth based on
salary, based on the rest of their peers.
But it's actually there's no correlation to actually what guys are being paid.
No, there is because it's all based on their peers.
Right, but those numbers are not actually we're not actually seeing them develop into real contracts.
I mean, sometimes,
not really.
I mean, Gerrit Cole's developed into a real contract.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Some of them. I mean, I just don't think it's the norm. But anyway, that's fine. Like, he's worth that for sure. Still looking at what he is. I'm trying to see what I gave him. I feel like
you gave him a four-year extension. Didn't you give him a four-year extension?
I think so. And I think it was for, I don't know why I'm not seeing it in here. I know I put it in here. And I think it was based on... It was around $19 million. I think it was between $19 and $20 million, I believe, for the remainder. I think it was a buyout for the next year. Or no, it was in addition to this next year, and I think it was around $19 million.
So it's essentially become a five-year contract.
Yeah, I think so. I'm misremembering right now. But yes, it was around it was a significant contract.
I think a three-year extension, so in addition to this coming year, three more years after that, and then he would demand about
$16 to $18 million a year.
And I think I bumped him up from there, and I think it was 19. I'm almost positive it was 19.
And I don't know if the Yankees would pay him that. But
Well they should.
Okay, but
and
I don't know if they're going to, because what is the value for them in that? Because then they're paying, so like they're paying Aaron Hicks into his 37-year-old year, which some people say is asinine, but the value for them was buying out the last year of arbitration and locking up a player they believe in for a low AAV. What is the value in extending LeMahieu at $18 million AAV into his mid-30s?
The value is not is having him on the team. The value is locking him
obviously
up to be a roster. No, but that's a big thing. Because if you don't have him there, then you're losing a significant piece to your puzzle, to what you think could be a championship team. You take DJ LeMahieu off this team, it's very different.
So not signing Didi maybe gave LeMahieu leverage.
I don't think it was really correlated. I think the fact that no, because I think that they just
no. LeMahieu will have leverage in negotiations.
I don't think it's going to come down to that because it's not happening this year. So we know all the money that comes off the books next year. So I don't think it really has much to do with what Didi is doing. Everything with Didi was attached to Glaber. Everything. It was all about controllable or not controllable and the money. To me, I don't think there was a correlation there. Will it help? Sure. I mean, I guess, but I don't think there was.
But say the
they
Yankees
were making a decision
signed,
based off of that.
Say the Yankees had signed Didi to a 4-year contract, and they obviously would have Glaber for second base. Then what would LeMahieu would have less leverage going into negotiations with the Yankees, because he would be looking at a backup second baseman, first baseman, third baseman role, which is what he was signed to at $12 million a year.
Yeah. All right. I guess if you're looking at it by a position has opened up full time,
yeah,
with second baseman.
Because now he can go and say, well, you need me to be your starting second baseman. Who are you going to have at starting second base? No one better than me.
TJ would never say that.
His agent might.
His agent's probably his brother-in-law.
You know, you can find out that information.
Doesn't matter.
So your
bottom line is they need to extend him. I mean, there was definitely the reason it was in my plans is because I see him as an invaluable piece. The guy came over and far exceeded what he was paid this year. Pay the man. He's an integral part of this team moving forward next year and into the years. Because again, I still think that he's one of those guys that can play well into his 30s and be an effective player. He's got those types of raw mechanics that just look like they translate. You don't see an injury history with him. He takes care of himself. He's all business. He can play everywhere. He's invaluable to this team. So re-sign him or extend him so that we're not going up. Because I guarantee you someone else will pay that man at the end of the season. And multiple teams will line up to pay that man after they saw what he did this past year. So I would like it to happen sooner than later. And I hope that the Steinbrenners feel the same way.
Chip Walker.
And that's
and
still,
all these.
I'm sorry, real quick. That is something that also we got 2 months, two and a half months till the season, till spring training starts. These are now months that the Yankees, who are identifying trades within, you know, potential trades to fill out their roster, can also, they know where they are next year. They know where they are in 2022 and 23. They can kind of see a little bit more into the future now. So this might be a month where they're making some of these extensions. So would not surprise me if in January we saw an extension for DJ LeMahieu.
Yeah, but I don't think it would take effect until 2021 because of the luxury tax.
No, that's fine, but there's still a deal in writing of what's going to happen. Yeah, it could be an addition. It could be an extension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chip Walker, in all these discussions of Yankees pitching for 2020, I never see a mention of Domingo Germán. He was 18-4 last year. He says, spare me the wins don't matter garbage. And even more significantly, the team was 21-6 in his starts, same as Verlander's record. I know he was suspended for supposedly slapping his girlfriend, but seriously, isn't he a factor for the Yanks next season? He was already suspended for the rest of 2019 in the playoffs. How much worse can his punishment be, especially for a single incident? Why is he being ignored or overlooked?
Well, I think he's being ignored. I don't think he's being ignored. I don't think he's being overlooked. I think that he is a very unknown quantity right now. I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen with him. And, you know, all of us speculating on what happens is just that. It's speculation. Nobody knows. The inside the Yankees, they know. They understand what's probably going to happen, I would assume. They probably have some good idea of what MLB will do or what they will do, because they have more information about what happened. I think it's unfair for any of us to speculate more on this, because we just don't know the facts, and that's also the bottom line.
It's a sensitive topic.
But the Yankees know. There hasn't been a ruling on what he's going to be on the field. If we're just talking about on the field,
we know he can be a quality pitcher,
right? But we don't know if he's going to be on the field. That's the
right
thing.
So you can't put your eggs in the basket of somebody that you don't even know if they're going to be there.
Right, and
it's foolish.
Like I said, the Yankees probably know more. I'm guarantee they know more of what his situation is going to be next year. They're not talking about it because. Two things. They don't want to talk about it because of the sensitivity of the matter. And you know, they're not making their decisions based on what he is. Because I think at this point, if you're a team and you have an uncertain player, I don't care what he did last year. You don't know he's going to be on the field. So you have to move forward like he's not there. If he's there and the situation, you know, is more clear and, it's decided that he is going to play on the team, well, then you can make, you know, assessments and adjustments at that point. But to me, it's impossible to do.
If he's suspended even for a little bit of the first half of 2020, or if he's not, he'll play a factor somehow. Yeah. Somebody will be injured next year for the Yankees. It always happens.
Yeah.
There'll be a spot in the rotation.
I mean, if you're looking at just the on the field, because, you know, at some point, especially when you're doing a podcast like this, you have to just look at what pieces are on the field, okay? And if you're looking at that, yes, he's an effective player. He pitched very well last year. He probably changed could have changed the outcome of the Yankees season by not being there. His actions affected the Yankees on the field. There's no doubt about that, because he was an effective pitcher on the field, and he could have come in at key moments. Maybe when not a starting pitcher, but could have come in at key moments and been a game changer. It absolutely could have affected what they did. So when you're looking at what that guy is on the field, yes, he is an effective player. He is a good player that took a step forward on the field last year. And it hurts the Yankees for him not being on the field. But none of that matters right now, because you don't know where he's going to be or what the severity or the details of what happened. So you just don't know, and you can't really speculate on it. That's it. For me, it's as simple as that.
And one thing Chip mentioned, so he was 18-4 last year, and then he says, but more importantly, 21-6. The team was 21-6 in his starts. I do kind of like looking at the team record in a start by a pitcher more than the pitcher win itself. I think that does tell a better story.
I mean, it tells the same story though.
Not this particular case.
Yeah, it does. 18-4 and 21-6. It's a lot of success.
No. Okay, in this case, but I'm saying. If just a general rule of thumb.
No, I'm saying.
I like looking at the team win-loss record, even though it still doesn't necessarily tell the whole story.
Yeah.
Because
DeGrom.
Well, Felix Hernandez. that's a pitcher. But a team could lose the game, but the pitcher could have pitched 8 shutout innings, but they just lose the game. Well, okay, that's not the pitcher's fault. But
right.
You know. It's all you got to look at a lot of different things, but there are other metrics to show that Domingo Germán was an effective pitcher last year.
Yeah, I'll bring up the old...
Besides his record.
When convenient, I will bring up the old stats.
Final question / submission. This one came in a few weeks ago, but I thought it was really interesting and took me a little while to look up. It's from our friend Steph S. Hey guys, in episode 390, Max brought up a couple times that he's not a fan of certain offensive stats that are commonly used to evaluate hitters, and he seemed to favor more somewhat obscure metrics. As a thought experiment, what would your dream lineup be according to each of your top preferred offensive stat? We can suspend reality and include players not actually on the Yankees currently, but they should be current active players. And then we get a table tennis update.
Well, this is, first of all, Steph, we've kind of made the assumption that is a woman / girl / female. It could go both ways. Steph could be a man's name as well. So we're not totally sure. But the fact that roommate is also a woman that plays ping pong or table tennis, however you want to say it, we're going with that it's a she. So
yeah, you were confused. I was not. Well, another U.S. table tennis update.
Who knows?
My roommate and a couple other U.S. players are in Toronto now playing in the Canadian Open. This was a few weeks ago, so I guess we could look up the results. I think they've all...
been eliminated before the main draws by various players from Asia, but the U.S. women's world rankings are the highest they've ever been, so a silver lining there. Happy holidays and go Yankees.
And just some background information. We've been getting table tennis updates on a weekly basis, and I appreciate them. I was in Jersey at my dad's place and on Christmas or the day before Christmas, Monday, whatever Monday was, and I was up playing ping pong. I call it ping
pong. He's got a table?
Yeah, it's a really crappy table that's been beat up.
Do you hold the paddle
beer.
Right side up or upside down?
Oh, I hold it up regularly. I don't hold it. There's like a
lot of the
Chinese players or Taiwanese players or the Asian players hold it so because they don't the paddle goes the same way. You use the same side of the paddle a lot of times. I think most of the good players do it that way. Like the high level players do keep it that way. Because you can probably just go get they're more skilled in that sense. But no, I absolutely do not. I wind up big time for spikes. Anyway, we were up to like 4 in the morning.
Do you remember if Forrest Gump held it like that?
4 in the morning playing ping pong.
Because he's the most famous ping pong player I know.
I don't remember if he did or not. I'm trying to picture it in my mind. Maybe he did. I think he held it.
I think he held it regular.
I think he might have too. Trying to think of that you know, when he was in the barracks and like smacking the balls against.
Playing against the wall?
Yeah. Because he definitely wound up and hit a forehand. And the forehand on a lot of some of these players is actually a backhand that's like, it hurts my elbow just to do that.
You get table tennis elbow.
Yeah. which also stems from Nintendo elbow and pitching too much from sixth grade through high school.
Yeah. So.
Anyway, I was up till four in the morning. I was up till 4 in the morning playing ping pong, and I did not lose. Just for the record,
4 in the morning, Jesus.
Yeah,
I'd be dead for like 2 weeks after that.
Yeah,
I think the best metric to use, it's just the easiest catch-all metric, is WRC plus, and it's weighted runs created plus. It is. I'll just read the definition. It's an improved version of Bill James's runs created stat, which attempted to quantify a player's total offensive value and measure it by runs. In runs created, instead of looking at a player's line and listing out all the details like 23 doubles, 15 home runs, 55 walks, etc., the information is synthesized into one metric in order to say player X was worth 24 runs to his team last year. And then the plus just is adjusted to parks and league average, with 100 always being league average. So if your WRC plus is 110, that means you were 10% better than the league average at your total offensive value to your team. So I think that's an easy catch-all, and you just list it top down, because as we've seen, a lot of the best hitters on teams are hitting second now. That's why Aaron Judge hits second. That's why Mike Trout hits second. And you would say, well, why wouldn't you want to hit them first? Because they're going to get about 20 more plate appearances hitting first than they are second. Well, any value you get by getting them up 20 or 25 more times in a season is negated by the fact that they're going to be hitting at least once in those games with the bases empty every time, because they'd be leading off the game. So that's why the second spot in the order is now the most valuable. It's where your best hitter goes, because they're going to get up the most and also come up in situations to produce runs with guys on base.
And this is not that far off from you know, conventional thinking, because conventional thinking has always been you put your best guy in the three spot.
Right. What was the old way of thinking? Like speed first,
contact second,
overall, best hitter overall third,
power four,
power guy 4-5, and then you know whatever the rest
then,
of your
and then a lot of times you
out.
Do it over again. You could add more power, or you go backwards.
Or some guys, you go backwards. In the American League, at least, not in the National League because you got the pitcher, but in the American League, you'd say, oh, well, we want a speed guy at the bottom, too, so he can get on for the top of the order.
Right, so you put a speed guy in the 9 spot, conventional, and then you probably put your catcher at 8.
Right. But that's not how teams are doing it anymore.
Right.
And so 64% of leadoff hitters' plate appearances are with the bases empty. It's the highest of any spot in the order. And you gain about, as I said, 23 plate appearances for every position in the lineup. So 1 through 9. So to answer the question, and I just used 2019 WRC plus leaders by position, I'll run through it quickly. Yasmani Grandal led for catchers at 121. Pete Alonso at first base, 143. Ketel Marte at 150 at second base. But he also split time in the outfield, so there's a little fudging there to get him at second base. He did play 460 innings at second base, though. Alex Bregman, third base, 168. Xander Bogaerts, 141 at shortstop. Cody Bellinger in the outfield. Mike Trout in the outfield. And Christian Yelich in the outfield. And then the DH spot was Nelson Cruz. So this is how...
But also, yeah. I think Mike Trout with a 180 WRC+. Yeah. Plus,
highest.
The next guy closest to him was Yelich at 174.
Yeah.
With Bregman being at 168. So there's a pretty significant difference.
Yeah, and obviously Mike Trout led all of baseball in WRC+. Plus. He's the best baseball player on the planet, and it's not even close. So this is how I would order this lineup. Christian Yelich leading off, Mike Trout second, Bregman third, Cruz fourth, Bellinger fifth, Ketel Marte sixth, Pete Alonso seventh, Xander Bogaerts eighth, Yasmani Grandal ninth. And this is ordered by highest WRC plus to lowest, with the exception of Trout being the number two hitter because he's our best hitter. And then I put Yelich at number one because he's our second best hitter.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. If we're going off WRC plus and that's the catch-all, and that's really what a lot of teams are making their lineup decisions based off of. It's unfortunate that we don't see any Yankees on this.
So we could put DJ LeMahieu at second base if that makes you feel better.
It does.
He would bat eighth.
It's a hell of a lineup.
An outfield of Yelich,
Pete Alonso's
Trout,
like 40 years
Bellinger.
Old. He might have a big fall off a cliff. That guy, I can't look at him, man. I know he's a good player and like he's fun for the Mets fans and all that. He's such a goober. Like he legitimately looks like he's
like
45 years old. I don't know.
Yeah, but
he
like he's got a dad bod. His nickname is the Polar Bear. Like it's kind of fun. I don't hate the Mets. Do you hate the Mets?
No, I don't hate the Mets.
No. So
I'm indifferent.
Exactly.
I must say though that it's ticking up a little bit though with the additions that they're making.
Is it?
It's pissing me off that they're adding all these Yankees.
Are you gonna root for Betances?
I mean, I like the player. I'm not gonna root for him to succeed for the team. I hope he has a good year in the Mets. I don't want the Mets to be... Let me tell you how I feel. I don't want the Mets to be good.
Okay, but I hope
they don't really bother me.
Because I'm a Dellin Betances fan, I hope he has a good year and someone pays him money next year.
Me too.
Because he deserves it for how good of a player he's been for so long.
Yes. And it's very clear that he wanted to stay in New York. The guy grew up here, has been here his whole life. He wants to stay here. So there's a very good possibility he pitches, rehabs, doesn't pitch... Great, pitches okay, who knows, and then resigns with the Yankees.
Did you see him in that Instagram post with the beard? That beard's looking rough.
I did not see the beard.
Yeah, it's patchy.
Yeah.
It's because he hasn't been able to grow it on the Yankees. I guess that's score one for all the fans out there that like the facial hair policy.
Okay.
I made this because WRC plus, like I'm more into those sorts of metrics.
Right,
but
you're the resident nerd of the two of us.
But I feel like you've even come around on a lot of this stuff and you understand the value in looking
sure.
WRC plus, right?
Yeah, no. I absolutely see the value when you look at these. My problem with metrics, I wouldn't call it a problem. It's just, I think that people have to understand why they're being used and how they're being used. I like these metrics when you see a big sample size. I think then you can actually tell a story of what somebody is and who they are on a general level. I don't think it talks to like the clutchness, the specific incidences or situations, but I think you can get a very good idea. I think that when you're using these numbers, they can be used to back up what you're seeing or potentially to change what you're seeing because what you're seeing can absolutely be a mirage sometimes. I don't dispute that. So I think that they are extremely valuable, but I also think that they should be used in correlation and in tandem with what old school scouts look for and identify as guys who are talented and good at things. Because I think all of that stuff is very valuable. And now you just have some extra additional information that can identify players that maybe you wouldn't see or put them in different positions or improve them in certain ways. So I think it's all extremely valuable. I don't think either one should be on an island.
I would like to see something like WRC plus on the stat lines on TV broadcasts. When a player gets up to bat.
Yeah.
In addition to keep batting average there, you can keep home runs there, even you can keep RBIs there if you want to keep it there. But I would like to see something like WRC plus as well.
It would not surprise me if they started making. I think what they, because the baseball cards are kind of back right now. They're kind of the hotness.
There's a new documentary on Netflix that I want to watch.
Oh yeah, I saw that
baseball card like.
It's called. It looks like Topps. Looks like the Topps logo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I gotta watch that too. But I mean, I was huge into baseball cards when I was a kid. I have boxes and boxes and boxes of baseball cards, and binders. I have so many, and that's how I learned, you know, statistics. That's how I learned who was good and who wasn't, and that's how I knew who the players were on the teams. That's how I learned. I got Kemp a 2019 Yankees cards. I just got like some crappy version of them, you know, like a, I don't know.
Was it just like the team, like the
25 players on the team? I just did it so he could look, that there were 19 players in the pack, and I had to take out a few guys, but there were that are not here any longer, and for some ungodknown reason they're still selling 2019 Yankees packs with Sonny Gray on the freaking team. That one got burned, but the I took some of these guys out because he's still the first player he says is Didi, and I'm like, buddy, I'm sorry, man, Didi's on a different team now, so he's starting to understand that a little bit. But anyway, it's more like a flash card for me. Like, they're gonna get all jacked up, but it's for him to identify who the players are. It's me starting my training.
So remember I showed you, Leanne gave me those baseball cufflinks for the wedding.
Yes.
And they were made from a real baseball that Didi Gregorius hit
right.
in a game.
Yeah.
And it was like a ground out or whatever. And we were just joking that like, oh, he moved a runner over, did something productive.
Right.
But it came up over the weekend. She was talking about, because we were at her family's for Christmas. And she was like, oh, I got Andrew a Didi, you know, cufflinks. And then I go, you know, Leanne, I haven't been able to break it to you. Didi Gregorius is no longer on the Yankees, and her face just dropped. She's like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, but the thing is with Didi is, like, it's so unfortunate for so many other reasons.
I still love him.
Yeah, his time here was definitely, I think, very positive for a lot of Yankees fans. And like, there's definitely connections, too, with, you know, with the ALDS game 2 game, the ALDS game, and the fact that we had all those people on right field and he hit a ball at us. Like, there's a lot of Didi ties that I will always remember very fondly. There's a great picture of him rounding third with two fingers up, and you see the sea of white in right
in the
field.
Background.
It's awesome. So
Didi Gregorius, like, it's not going to shock me in 25 years when he is invited back to Old Timers Day.
Oh, hell no. No, it would not.
And he'll get us a rousing standing ovation.
Damn right he would. Unless he goes somewhere else after this year, like to the Red Sox or something, and just is a Yankee killer.
That
could change.
But as of right now, we're just playing it out. Yeah. All right, let's get into out of left field.
Find that out. Sanchez destroys that to left field.
There it goes. Deep to left. Really deep.
In the air to left field. Back at the track at the wall.
I pissed on a public building.
Yeah.
All right. So being the holiday season, and we didn't really spend time on Festivus airing of grievances. I think, you know why? We still had the glow from signing Gerrit Cole. We weren't angry, but now it's been a week since then, so we're angry again. We got a few things to bitch about, Scott.
Yeah, I think it's appropriate for out of left field to have the airing of grievances in Festivus tradition. We're both big Seinfeld fans. So mine's not really that serious, but it's annoying to me, and I'll choose this. So during the holiday season, people are decorating their house, putting the lights up, doing all these things, and it doesn't necessarily need to be Christmas. You see snowman decorations, you see snowflakes blinking here and there, and all these things. So it's just more the winter season people put holiday decorations up. I cannot stand the inflatable decorations. I hate them. I think they are the dumbest thing on the face of the planet, and I'll tell you why. During the day, you know, when the sun is up and when everybody, the majority of the time, people are awake and like out and about, these things look like dead bodies laying on people's yards.
It's like a sniper was in another yard, just
and then all of a sudden
plowing them down.
All of a sudden, they rise up when the sun goes down and the fan goes on. It's the most ridiculous thing. And for a guy that owns a house and has to deal with the lawn and maintenance, I would never in a million years put this out there purely because it suffocates my lawn, and
but
that would piss me off.
In fairness, in the Northeast, grass is dead in the winter anyway. Where you are
no,
in
it's,
Virginia,
it's everywhere.
It's probably a little bit more alive, right?
No, it's everywhere. You still have, when grass cannot breathe, whether it's the winter or the spring or summer, it's not good. It's still not good. You still have warmer days. This whole week in New York, it's been like 40, 50 degrees.
Yeah, it's been beautiful.
You're suffocating your lawn. You're suffocating the lawn and killing the root system by having these stupid decorations out there. So do they look good at night?
No, they
don't.
I don't
think they look very good.
No. The inflatable Christmas decorations or holiday decorations are tacky. And I'm sorry if anyone out there, you have these on your front lawn. They're tacky.
People like tacky during the Christmas season, and that's fine. Like, when you go gaudy on the lights, it always goes to the tacky side. And that's fine, because it is what it is. Like, I don't mind that. I wouldn't do it on my house necessarily, but I sometimes like looking at some of the people that go out and do it. Like, more power to you.
Oh,
you
no.
You do that, like, cool.
If they go Clark Griswold on their house, like, cool. That like, I don't want to live next to you because that'd be annoying.
Yeah.
But I respect that, and I'll drive by it. I'll stop. I'll enjoy it for a few minutes and then drive on.
Yes. But the inflatables on everybody's yard that come from
Walmart,
I got problems with. And I hate, and it's all because it's not even what they look like at night. Like, that to me, fine. Whatever. I cannot handle when I just see a puddle of whatever the hell that parachute laying on everybody's yard. It's just,
no, you described it. You described it well. Just like a dead snowman.
It's a sad sight. It's a sad sight. So
on the lawn
the entire time during the day, you just have parachutes laying all over your front yard.
Yeah.
That's not good. That's not a good aesthetic. That's not getting me in the holiday season. If you had one of those like plastic Rudolphs out there, that would cheer me up better than seeing
Santa. Those look the same during the day as and at night. Yeah, I'm okay with that.
They're like vampire decorations.
did someone in your family have these? Is this why
No.
You just driving by, you saw a lot of them this weekend?
If somebody in my family had one of these, we would have it out.
You just go in the front lawn and just like...
It would be gone.
Cut a hole in it so it couldn't inflate at night.
It would be gone, yes.
Well, I guess a squirrel got to it. Yeah, you got a squirrel problem.
You got a squirrel problem. They're attacking. See, the squirrels would leave them. That's the thing. They're like, oh, they're gonna prime the grass for me to dig a bigger hole on.
They'll dig a hole in your car gas tank, but won't dig a hole in the inflatable Santa
Claus. No, that would be helping me out.
Yeah. All right, that's a good one. I wanna bitch about Star Wars. So, I don't know. People probably don't know this about me. I'm a big Star Wars fan. It's by far my favorite movie franchise
and
out there.
Before you do this though, it just came out. So there's a lot of people that haven't seen it.
Yeah, spoilers.
So fine. If you want to hear this, if you haven't seen it and you don't want to hear any of this, turn this off now because I'm sure will be spoilers in what he's about to say.
So when I grew up, Star Wars was always my favorite. I had all the toys, all the action figures, the Millennium Falcon. Like I would set up like giant battles with my friends when we were younger.
Okay.
And you know, the prequels sucked as movies, but you know, I could still whatever. I just liked the franchise in general. And when The Force Awakens came out, you and I talked about it, and I really enjoyed that movie despite it being just a reboot basically of the original one.
Yeah.
And then The Last Jedi, I know it's been like polarizing. Like, I'm sure you've seen like people are in one side or another on that movie. And while it's not, I don't love it. I also can recognize like it's a good movie. And then where this most recent one went, you look at the entire trilogy and it's the dumbest freaking thing I've ever seen. How can you bring the Emperor back? And just be like, oh yeah, he's back. He's been here the whole time, even though in the last two movies we never mentioned him. But we're just retconning everything we've done in the last two movies and spent billions of dollars on producing. I don't know how Disney did this. And it kind of baffles my mind that they went into the biggest movie franchise in the world and were just like, yeah, we're going to wing it. We're going to hire guys and we're going to wing it.
So we've made it a tradition now to watch the Star Wars movies on the day after Christmas every year. And we go out, my family goes out. So this year it was my sister, my brother-in-law, my niece, this is the first time she's come because she's a little older now. And then my wife and my brother. So we all go out and we watch Star Wars, the new one. And it's probably not the greatest thing because we all just like we make fun of things in a row. Like we're sitting in these seats.
Do you talk during the movie?
Like we'll whisper, we'll like nudge each other on like inside jokes occasionally. You know what I mean? Just like not like bull out talking. But there were so many times in this movie that there were Spaceball references that I couldn't get past. What? Like, oh, they've jammed our radar. I'm like, oh, God, how do you not go to the Raspberry? Like, immediately I'm like, oh, Lone Star. And I'm thinking, like, there's only one person there. And yeah, we're all, like, looking at each other and, like, and, like, doing stupid things like that. And there were so many times during this particular movie, this one, that were, like, set up beautifully for a Spaceballs moment to make fun of. It was just, there was a lot of cheese in this one. And
it was very fan service-y. And I don't. And I can live with that if the story makes sense, but this story didn't make sense based on the last movie. And I'm not necessarily blaming the like J.J. Abrams for this final movie that he just made. The Last Jedi was not really a sequel to The Force Awakens. Rian Johnson made The Last Jedi, and he basically threw out everything J.J. Abrams did. And then J.J. Abrams comes in for the last movie and throws out everything Rian Johnson did in The Last Jedi. Again, just get on the same page. Make a movie, make an arc for three movies that makes sense, please.
Here's what I don't get. Because in the beginning, they made it very clear that it wasn't going to be the same director for the three movies that are coming out, right? So,
they fired, I think his name's Trevorrow or something,
but
for the third one.
How do you not have a contract for the trilogy for one guy? To me, you got to keep the directors the same so that you do have some consistency between them.
Even if you don't keep the directors the same, you need to have an outline set.
But that just takes away. Doesn't that take away from what the director does then? You're handcuffing that director for coming in. Why not, if you have the confidence in the guy to take over this massive trilogy that's, you know, arguably the most famous and popular trilogy in all of mankind, to sign that guy for the three.
Well, so
you have that consistency.
Just because there's different directors, you can have a unified writing team, because George Lucas didn't direct all of the original Star Wars movies. He only did the first one. And then there were different directors for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but he wrote them.
Right.
Yeah. So as long as you have a consistent story.
I guess. But when you look back at those, and I understand that there's limited stuff that they could have done back then as well because of just the way that movies
have evolved.
Just
technology wasn't. Yeah.
They all felt very similar, you know, in the look and feel.
Yes. Yeah, because George Lucas, again, even though he wasn't the director, he was the executive producer. He made sure everything was his vision.
Yeah.
I liked the movie in the sense that I like Star Wars, and I got enjoyment from different aspects of it, and it looked, in my opinion, excellent. And there were some cool new things in the movie. But just like so did you fall for when they fake killed Chewie?
No.
Yeah, I knew he was coming back, but I felt bad because there was a kid in my theater, like a couple rows up from me, screaming when he thought Chewie died.
Well, I mean,
because Chewie's probably his friggin' hero.
That's kind of what they were going for then, I guess, right?
I guess they made the 9-year-old scream in terror.
It was very clear that there were more than one transport.
But then they retconned that 20 seconds later.
Yeah. No, it was very... I did not fall for it. I was like, there's no way they killed him off like that.
Killed and then brought back so many people in that movie, I laughed.
Yeah, the guy that was the... I don't want to give too much away. We already said spoiler.
Why?
Right?
We already
so
said
no one's
spoilers.
Listening. The spy guy?
The snitch?
I hate him. First of
Hux?
All, I hate him as a character in the first place.
Sexy Huxy?
He's never been believable. He's always been an asshole. Like, the whole thing was stupid. That whole thing was dumb.
Well, they just basically created a second empire for no reason.
Yeah, I don't know. And the whole fact that, like, you have this... you're going to bring the emperor back. And now we're going to, you know, make up the lineage of Rey. And you have this massive fleet of, like, huge ships. Like, just massive fleets. Uh-huh. Why not turn a force field on and just swat some flies?
No, they only have one. They only have one signal that can control 1,000 ships.
Two. It's just so stupid.
Because plot.
Yeah, I guess. Bad implementation of that. Like, that's not a battle. That's flies attacking a tiger.
No, you can't.
I don't care how many flies attack a tiger. I don't care how many. Never gonna win.
No. You feared, like when I was a kid, I was like, oh man, the Death Star, that's scary. You can wrap your head around, like, oh, that's the one big bad thing they need to blow up. But now when like there's 1,000 things and they all destroy planets, it's like, all right, this is, and I guess now I'm older, so it's different, but it's just silly.
Did you catch the massive Goonies reference in here?
Oh, yeah, when they had when they had to look at the old Death Star to find out, like, to line it up.
It was a it was almost the exact same scene. Because
but that's okay. That's kind of a nod to Goonies more than anything.
It's completely taking it. The Death Star was the monolith. Was where One-Eyed Willy is. Like, everything was right there. It was the exact same scene. They were on a rocky, like, terrain with grass, similar to the landscape you would see. You know, obviously not with the fiery ocean the way it was, but it's a similar landscape to what you would see in the Pacific Northwest with the monolith out there, and you're lining it up like a doubloon, like, oh, it must be One-Eye Willy, the treasure's there. Let's go there. It was just so ridiculous.
This movie was like a video game treasure hunt with set in Star Wars.
Yeah, I could see that. I don't know. There were a lot of very predictable things that happened, and like kind of a lot of eye rolls. In the way that things were going down. And I know, like, in even the original series, the original three, there's always, like, comedy built into it. There's always been, like, cheesy comedy built into it with the way that Han would talk to Luke and Leia. And, like, there was always that little cheese.
But it's, like, that sort of sarcastic humor.
Yeah.
Like, little sarcastic jabs that, like, broke tension in the movie.
Right. A little too much of that for me on this one, too.
Yeah.
Some of it was, like...
That stuff's okay.
I don't...
It's just my biggest issue is just the plot of the three movies doesn't make sense. And, you know, they all are going to make $1 billion plus, so Disney got what they paid for. But
and from what my brother-in-law is the bigger Star Wars nerd of all of us by far. He knows way more about any of this than I do. So now this is it? Like, this is the end of the Skywalker saga? Is that... no sense, because it's like the most clear beginning now to another set of movies.
Oh, yeah, they set it up for a new one at the end. But isn't it really the Emperor Palpatine saga? Not the Skywalker saga?
I guess...
He's the guy that basically controlled everything
from
the beginning to the end.
Yeah, but they're also talking about the fact that... Oh, yeah, she's just going to, like, oh, now I'm this. Now I'm... Everybody's dead, so I'm just going to take this name.
Yeah.
What are we doing here? Like, okay. Like, here, I'm just going to set it up for another however many movies. But from what my brother-in-law was saying, they're not going to... All these characters are no longer now?
Yeah, I mean, their contracts are all up. I mean, they could do another thing. They could do a thing in, you know, 20 years where they bring the characters back or something. I don't think they're going to make another movie with these characters in the next... 3 to 5 years.
I'd say so. My prediction was possibly like close to 10 years, because what they're going to do now is they're going to wait till all of the kids that are, you know, 9, 10, 11 through 20 are going to grow older and then have the nostalgia to kick back on.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why Star Wars has been so successful and makes so much money, is because of the nostalgia factor.
Right.
Like, my parents love the movies. I love the movies. And I'm sure my kids eventually will love the movies. Like, you'll show it to Kemp, and I'm sure he'll get a kick out of it, and then keep going back.
Right. And I'll go back, too. I couldn't believe they made a Goonies reference, though. And, oh, yeah, I got another one. Why do we have a guy from Lord of the Rings in the thing that's, like, clearly the guy from Lord of the Rings that they identify and, like, zoom in on when he says, like, three lines in the whole movie? He was just not necessary to be there. Because everybody's, as soon as you see him, the first thing you think of, that's a hobbit. Everybody, I guarantee everybody thought that's a hobbit.
Which guy? I don't even know.
You don't know. Did you not watch
Lord of the Rings? I'm not a Lord of the Rings guy.
How are you not a Lord of the Rings guy when you're a Star Wars guy? I thought you people were all the same.
You people.
Trekkies are different than Star Wars people. I know that. But I thought Lord of the Rings
I just
and
never
Star
got
Wars
into
were.
Lord of the Rings.
He was one of the guys at the Rebel base that looks like a hobbit. I don't know how else to describe it. He's a freaking hobbit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. Okay.
He's the guy that you recognize of all of them. And you're like... That was
I think he's J.J. Abrams' friend.
Well, oh yeah, because Abrams did The Lord of the Rings, right? Didn't he do some of them? One of them?
No.
No?
No.
I made that up. Either way, clearly a hobbit in the Star Wars movie. It was a cross that I didn't need.
Yeah.
For a character that was not any relevance to anything.
Have you been watching The Mandalorian?
I have not yet.
Solid.
Yeah, I've actually heard a lot of much better things about that than the movie.
Yeah, Baby Yoda's fun.
Yeah, I like the premise of what it is.
Yeah, it's cool.
The fact that they're going through that whole story. So,
all right. Sorry for anyone who's not a Star Wars fan.
Well, they turned it off.
We did do spoiler warnings. That's going to do it for this episode. Next time we talk to you, we'll be in the new year. Submit your mailbag questions and call the voicemail line, 646-480-0342. Scott, any last words?
No, happy new year to everybody. We'll talk to you next year. Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.